It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about the Ten Commandments. Of course, they play an important role in the faiths of many, but they're also a significant part of our culture. A new Ten Commandments monument was just erected on the lawn of the State House in Oklahoma to replace the one that was destroyed. Before that, a new blockbuster movie has been made to retell the story of Moses and the Ten Commandments. And of course, they also make their way into politics and law. We're going to look into the history and significance of this moral code today. We'll also talk about other moral codes, and we want to hear from you this hour. What role do the Ten Commandments play in your life? You can join the conversation, Talk of Iowa, at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPRTalk. You can also send email. I guess I already mentioned email. You can call us as well, 866-780-9100. With me right now, Bob Cargill. He's Assistant Professor of Classics and Religious Studies at the University of Iowa. Hello, Bob.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Diana Cates is also here. She's Departmental Chair and Professor of Religious Ethics in the Religious Studies Department at the University of Iowa. Hello, Diana.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you for being here. And Dennis Goldford will join us shortly. He's a Professor of Political Science at Drake University. And the Ten Commandments, when we say the Ten Commandments, I think a lot of us immediately start ticking off a few of them. Maybe
right.
Some people can probably list at least 10.
Right.
But, you know, we think we know what we're talking about. But, Bob, this list of Ten Commandments is not as straightforward as many of us might believe.
That's right. The number 10 was basically chosen as a mnemonic device, as a way to help memorize the Ten Commandments. And what the first thing, when I teach this to freshmen, the first thing that the freshmen don't realize is that there are actually more than Ten Commandments in the list, right? So in the Jewish tradition, there are 613 commandments, but these are the 10. But when you look at the 10, there are actually more than 10, and different groups count them differently, combine them, split them into two in order to arrive at the number 10.
All right. So when we talk about the Ten Commandments, is there a general list that seems to have been agreed on at this point in our history?
Yeah. And again, different traditions count them differently. So if I may, just, you know, walking through them, the Jewish faith starts with the opening declaration, I am the Lord your God, right? That's a commandment in the Jewish faith, whereas Christian traditions might see that as like a preamble, kind of this is the opening of this covenant, right? So I'm the Lord your God is considered one. You shall have no other gods before me would be one. No graven images or no likenesses, so no idols. Don't take the Lord's name in vain. Don't use it. And we can talk about what that means in a little bit. Remember the Sabbath. Honor thy father and mother. Don't kill. And we can talk about what that means. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness. And then the covetings, right? And the covetings are counted as one in the Jewish tradition. For instance, the Catholic tradition breaks it up into two so they can arrive at the number 10.
Okay.
So those are the 12 commandments that we number differently to arrive at the Ten Commandments.
And even the story of how those commandments came to be, there are a number of different interpretations of that as well.
Yeah. Anybody who does Hebrew Bible scholarship or studies the Christian Old Testament, you know, as soon as you get into a seminary or graduate level education, you realize that the Ten Commandments are messy business. That is, a lot of people know that they're actually given twice. They're actually given three times, to be honest. But they're given in Exodus chapter 20. We read them there, verses 1 through 17. They're given in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 6 through 21. And those are the two that most people are familiar with, mostly because they're almost identical. Now, the fact that there is a little difference in between the Exodus chapter 20 list and the Deuteronomy chapter 5 list says something. But then you have the story of Moses coming down the mountain, and he sees the golden calf, and he smashes the tablets. And God tells him in Exodus 34, come back up on the mountain and make two tablets of stone like the former ones, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets. This is Exodus 34:1. But then when you read the commandments that follow there, they're nothing like, with one or two exceptions, they're nothing like the commandments, the Ten Commandments that we're familiar with in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5.
So what did they say?
So these commandments are basically don't make covenants with the inhabitants of the land. Remember when the Israelites were going to go into the promised land, there was a very strict prohibition against making covenants with them. What God commanded them to do was to slaughter them, what we would consider today by any fair use of the term genocide. You go in and you slaughter man, woman, child, animal, everybody for purification purposes. That is, you didn't want the people to think that you were doing it for the money. You weren't conquering a city so you could take their assets. So you burned the assets, you burned the people, and you also didn't want their religions to creep into your religion. So it was noble. And again, we can talk about the ethics of this later, but it was considered noble to swipe out a people for religious purposes, because at least you weren't doing it for the money. So don't make covenants with other people of the land. Don't worship other gods. That one's in our list. Don't make idols. Okay, that one we know. You shall keep the festival of unleavened bread, right? So this is one of the festivals that's now part of the Passover tradition. All that the opens from the womb, the firstborn of every womb is mine, right? So the firstborn belongs to God. You have that in Exodus 34. Then you have basically your Sabbath. 6 days you work, keep the Sabbath. Observe the festival of weeks, the first fruits, the festival of ingathering. That's considered a commandment. Don't offer the blood of my sacrifice with leaven. We get that as one of the later traditions. The first fruits belong to God. And then you get this one that becomes pretty famous. Do not boil a kid in its mother's milk, which through a lot of interpretation becomes the basis of the rule of the Jewish kosher law of not mixing meats with milks. I think it was originally if you're gonna give birth to a calf, either kill the mom and raise the calf or kill the calf and keep the mom to bear. Don't kill them both, right? Because then you lose. But that become don't mix meats with milks over the years. And then God tells them, write these words down. So with the exception of two or three of those commands, the list that we have in Exodus 34, by the way, at the end of that list in 34, it says Moses came down from Mount Sinai and he came down from the mountain with the two tablets of covenant in his hand. So Exodus 34 makes very clear that these are the re-giving of the Ten Commandments, but anyone who can read can see they're completely different from the ones in Exodus chapter 20 and Deuteronomy 5.
So when we look at religion in history, as opposed to the different versions of the Bible, I mean, when did the Ten Commandments, the list that we are more familiar with today, when did that become a very important part of religion, that list?
As you move on in what we call Second Temple Judaism, that is post-exilic Judaism, when the Jews come back to Jerusalem, reestablish the temple in Jerusalem, and then with the rise of Christianity, we see some fascinating things happen throughout the Bible, but specifically with the Ten Commandments, and that is there's a realization that there's discrepancies in the Bible. Most biblical scholars will tell you that the Bible is actually not written by one single hand, Moses, as the Bible claims, but is a bunch of different authors, different traditions that are pieced together. And when it comes to, especially in Exodus, in the law codes in Exodus, it became clear that you have, for instance, Exodus chapter 20, the first giving of the Ten Commandments are almost completely different from Exodus 34. They realized this. They knew that the Bible had discrepancies. So they began to codify, to retell these stories to clean them up a little bit. And we see this in the Septuagint, in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. We see this in the Targums, the Aramaic translations of the Hebrew Bible. When these things are being translated, they're getting cleaned up. And so we begin to see these codifications of the Ten Commandments. And so, for instance, the Septuagint gives us a pretty standard list. Philo, the Jewish historian, follows the Septuagint, but he reverses the commands on killing and adultery. The Talmud, the Jewish legal book, the case law, the tradition in the 4th, 5th, 6th century CE, actually makes that, I am the Lord your God, the first one. And then combined, you shall have no other gods and no graven images into a single command. And that way you keep the 10. There was already this understanding that these are the 10 words because of the verse in Exodus 34:28. These are the 10 commandments. So they knew they had to get to 10, even though there were more than that. And then when Augustine came along, he said that first one, I am the Lord your God, isn't a command. So he split up the coveting command. So don't covet your neighbor's wife and don't covet your neighbor's house are now two separate commands. And so it's from there. Then once Christianity, with the rise of Christianity, the Ten Commandments actually become more of a symbol, especially since they're throwing out a couple of them, namely the Sabbath command.
Now, when we hear about the Ten Commandments, and we will talk a lot more about the Ten Commandments in modern culture and in politics, et cetera, in a few minutes, but when we hear about the Ten Commandments cropping up in the news and in all of these different ways, it seems to me that they are most often associated with Christianity. Do they play a different role in Judaism than they do in Christianity?
The phenomenon of the Ten Commandments as a symbol of what we call Judeo-Christian faith is a unique phenomenon. I mean, it's in that most people invoking the Ten Commandments, I don't really think, are familiar with what they say. They certainly can't name them. They may not know that there are more than 10. But if you look, for instance, again, people invoking these for modern legislative purposes, you shall have no other gods, no graven images. I mean, that violates the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution right there. So which is it, the First Amendment that we're going to protect and defend, or the Ten Commandments? Number two there, or one, depending on how you count it, says that you can worship no other god upon pain of death. So to the irony of putting the Ten Commandments in front of a U.S. courthouse is just beyond me.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about that a little later on. We're talking about the Ten Commandments this hour. We'll also talk about other moral codes. With me, Bob Cargill, Assistant Professor of Classics and Religious Studies at the University of Iowa. Diana Cates will come into the conversation in just a moment, Departmental Chair and Professor of Religious Ethics in the Religious Studies Department at the University of Iowa. And Dennis Goldford will join us in a few minutes as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Ten Commandments and the role that they play in faith, the role that they play in culture, the role that they play in pop culture, and also, of course, in politics and how we shape our laws in this country. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University, will join us in just a few minutes, and we'll get more into the politics of the Ten Commandments. With me right now, Bob Cargill is assistant professor of classics and religious studies at the University of Iowa. Diana Cates is also at the University of Iowa. She's departmental chair and professor of religious ethics in the religious studies department. And Diana, we've been focusing a lot on the commandments, where they come from, the differences in different lists, but let's talk about the importance of the Ten Commandments as a moral code. I mean, what made this list so incredibly important to so many people?
Well, part of what made it so important is just the power that Christianity has had in spreading around the world and perpetuating itself in Christian culture. So it's something that's universally known. And every culture has to have a moral code of some kind. We simply can't survive without it. Moral codes are basically our ways of holding each other accountable for our actions and even for our attitudes and our character. And if we can't do that, we literally can't get on with our lives. We can't get on with our lives in community. So I think over the years, partly because of the dominance of Christian culture and religion, it's been common to look for that one thing that we need in order to hold our communities together in the Ten Commandments. One thing that I think is interesting to see, though, that in the history of Christian ethics in particular, there's a little bit less conversation about the Ten Commandments per se and more about the sum of the commandments. And so you have statements in Scripture, but also very much in the history of Christian ethics, that the Ten Commandments are summarized by the love command. So love God above all things and love your neighbor as yourself. In some ways, I think people revert to the Ten Commandments when they're trying to figure out what love means and what love requires of them. Well, okay, so I know that means I should be faithful to my spouse, or I know that means I shouldn't steal from my neighbor, and so on. But to a large extent, I think people have focused more on the love your neighbor as yourself. And then as we've become more and more diverse religiously and more secular culture, especially in the United States, we've seen more and more people reverting to something a little bit more non-religiously descript, so something like the Golden Rule. So if I ask my students today, what moral code would you say that you generally follow in your life? Most of them will say the Golden Rule. And
so
there's a resonance between all of those, though. They all kind of hang together
right.
in the, you know, cultural imagination, especially of Americans.
So what do you, the Ten Commandments, as we've mentioned, is something that we hear a lot about. It's something that politicians like to bring up. It's something that gets argued about. What role do you really feel that it plays in our day-to-day culture and in the morality in the United States today?
Yeah. Well, I think part of the reason why we're hearing more and more about that from politicians and in other media is because a lot of people in our community, and I'll just talk about American culture right now, are really afraid. They see that we are becoming more and more diverse. Christianity doesn't command the culture in the way that it used to. We're seeing multiple religious traditions come forward with their very different moral codes, and folks are a little bit disoriented. They want to believe that there is one code, that they can know what it is, that they can follow it effectively, and that other people can be expected to follow the same code. So everybody's behavior is predictable. But when you start getting, so many different cultures and really different moralities now competing with each other, I think there's a tendency to want to look for something that's old, traditional, seems to have come directly from God, and seems therefore to be incontrovertible.
So this is something of a backlash. With the other moral codes that are involved in other religions, I mean, can we do a little bit of comparison contrast? What are some of these other codes? I mean, we hear a lot about Sharia law and things like that in the news, but what are some of the things that you feel we're responding to? Either one of you, Bob?
Yeah, sure. Most scholars will tell you that the Hebrew Bible's law codes, the Ten Commandments, but many of the laws are basically rooted on earlier law codes. That is, they weren't the first ones to come up with many of these laws, even though that's the Jewish tradition, that God – remember, it's very important. You find this peppered throughout the Hebrew Bible. Exodus 31:18 insists that this law code was written with the hand or with the finger of God. And this is, I think, why it's so appealing. Diana mentioned that people want something that comes directly from God, and here you have it, word for word. These came from the finger of God. Let's set aside the fact that God basically, if that's true, forgot what he said between the first giving and the second giving of the. But they're looking at this is the finger, the hand of God. But most scholars will demonstrate. They'll point to Hammurabi's law code, that these earlier law codes. Diana mentioned that you basically can't have civil society without laws. You have to have laws. Now, what they are and how they are enforced and who enforces them and then who's exempt from them are different details that different cultures exhibit. So too are the class of individuals violated. In the Hebrew Bible, one of the things that we find out is if you hurt or harm somebody or injure someone in an upper class above you, there's usually a steeper penalty than if you hurt a slave, let's say. Remember, slavery was not only legal, but how to make a slave was told to us by God in the Bible. So slavery is okay. Eating pork, no, but slavery is okay in this. And then, of course, Islam comes along and is based upon the Jewish and the Christian tradition. And if you read the Quran, you'll see that there's mention of not only Moses, but also of Jesus and these rules. So there is a continuation from the Near Eastern law codes through the Hebrew Bible, through the Christian New Testament, through the Quran, which gives us what we call our Western law codes.
I'm sorry, Diana.
Yeah, I think that it's not so much that we're aware that other religious traditions have other codes, and we're nervous about the fact that ours doesn't appear to be the only one and the obvious one. I think it's more that we look around, we see all different kinds of people, and a lot of them are doing things that we find really problematic. And so we make presumptions about what their codes must be without actually knowing. I think actually the code that a lot of folks, maybe especially conservative religious folks in America, are most worried about is not so much another religion's code, but kind of a non-religious or secular moral code. Something like an Enlightenment moral code about respect for persons or so on. So if you look at, for example, the recently developed atheist Ten Commandments, they're partly anti-theist. They're partly insisting that we don't need God in order to have morality, but they're also very much secular codes that suppose that we can all agree on what it means to respect each other, and we don't need God to tell us that. We don't need a belief in God to reinforce that. We can do fine on our own. And I think, you know, for folks—
And these were crowdsourced.
Yeah, so, yeah. I think that really worries a lot of people,
right?
Because if it doesn't have the authority of God, then it can't be enforced really on pain of death that you follow these rules. And then they just start to seem arbitrary. And then how can you really hold each other accountable to arbitrary rules?
Well, I, since you brought up this 10 non-commandments that were developed and crowdsourced by atheists in the United States, I'll read them. I have them right in front of me. So they are really non-commandment-y. One, be open-minded and be willing to alter your beliefs with new evidence. Two, strive to understand what is most likely to be true, not to believe what you wish to be true. Three, the scientific method is the most reliable way of understanding the natural world. Four, every person has the right to control their own body. Five, God is not necessary to be a good person or to live a full and meaningful life. Six, be mindful of the consequences of all your actions and recognize that you must take responsibility from them. Seven, treat others as you would want them to treat you. And so there's the golden rule, and can reasonably expect them to want to be treated. Think about their perspective. Eight, we have the responsibility to consider others, including future generations. Nine, there's no one right way to live. 10, leave the world a better place than you found it. And of course, a lot of these would be open to personal interpretation. But Bob, as you pointed out earlier, the Ten Commandments from the Bible, if you can make a list of 10, is also open to interpretation.
That's exactly right. The criticism against the atheist Ten Commandments, again, note that they went for 10. They're trying to make this, you know, fit into this mold.
Well, apparently human beings have always loved lists.
We love lists, and we love numbers that we can remember. Now, why they didn't just go with the 12, since 12 is very Jewish, you know, but they got 10. But the criticism is always, you know, if it doesn't come from an objective moral code, and if that's not based on God, then that they're arbitrary or that you can't enforce them. I do find interesting that this atheist code of ethics are basically, they are in a sense anti-theistic, and they're reactionary, and that's not necessarily the way that you want to go about forming it. But they do try to embrace modern society. That is, there is a scientific method, and just because people argued things 2,500 years ago doesn't mean that they're still true today. And the reality is that yes, they're open to subjective interpretation, but so too are the very Ten Commandments in the Bible. What does it mean, do not kill? You know, what does it mean, do not covet? What does it mean to remember the Sabbath, right? I mean, many, especially conservative evangelical Christians, are already tossing these out or reinterpreting them. So Christians don't keep the Sabbath anymore, even though that's one of the 10. The joke about do not covet is, are you dealing with a thought crime now? Are we entering into the realm of you're getting allowed to think certain things? And also, you know, we live in a capitalistic society, and coveting is basically one of the fundamental driving forces of capitalism, advertising, marketing. Hey, you don't have this, you need this, go buy this, and that, and we celebrate this as capitalists. You know, so what does it mean? What does it mean to have a society, a First Amendment of the Constitution that ensures religious freedom? You can worship whatever God you want to worship, when the very top of the list is you are not allowed, upon pain of death, to worship other gods. Are the Ten Commandments truly reflective of our modern legal framework? And if that's not the case, why do we keep insisting on it as a symbol?
Well, this is the perfect time to bring Dennis Goldford into the conversation. He's a professor of political science at Drake University, Flansburg Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, and author of The Constitution of Religious Freedom, God, Politics, and the First Amendment. Hello, Dennis.
Hello, everybody. The discussion makes me want to sit in on your other two guests' courses. It's been so fascinating.
Well, there's certainly a lot of fodder for conversation here. And Dennis, I mean, there are people, Bob was just saying that, you know, when we talk about the Ten Commandments possibly as the basis of laws in America, let's go through the list of Ten Commandments. I mean, what are actually laws in America?
Well, you know, they're... Some things aren't laws anymore, of course, but you know, depending upon the text you look at, and Bob's already adverted to that issue of the multiplicity of texts, and we can talk a little bit more about that in the legal and constitutional sense. But if you look at, you know, roughly speaking, the 10, quite a few of them are themselves not connected to ordinary civil or criminal law. Sure, thou shalt not kill, although again, there's a translation issue. If the translation is thou shalt not kill, that opens up things for the Quakers, of course, and raises the question of bearing arms in the military and things like that. If it's thou shalt not murder, which I think is more typical of Jewish translation, then that leaves open the possibility of taking arms in self-defense or in the military and things like that. But thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not murder, that's certainly part of our civil code in some sense. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, well, sure, in a trial, you can be convicted of perjury, although in the U.S., you know, you can swear, which itself was originally a religious act. And you'll notice if you look in the Constitution, there's reference there to the president swears or affirms. And affirm was considered to be a non-religious act, equally commanding. And you can affirm to tell the truth in a trial. You don't have to swear on a Bible, and you're still held liable on the cause of perjury. But there are laws, you know, I can't go sue you if you tell me something that turns out to be a lie unless you're defrauding me or doing something like that. But coveting, as Bob mentioned, you know, it makes our advertising industry function and our economy generally. Adultery, there used to be laws forbidding that. Those have tended to fall by the wayside. We tend not to have laws saying honor thy father and mother, remember the Sabbath day. We did have Sunday closing laws. Those basically have been eroded more or less by the dynamic of advanced capitalism. People want to be able to sell and buy on a Sunday. I grew up in a blue law state, not here in Iowa, and still, despite the fact that we've had commerce on Sundays, it still, in a way, amazes me to find the malls and everything open on a Sunday. Because where I grew up, they couldn't be. It was just drugstores and restaurants. So also graven image, thou shalt have no other gods before me. These aren't part of the American legal code. So you have a certain group of folks saying at some level the Ten Commandments are the foundation of our legal system. And I think that plugs in somewhat where Diana was talking, that I think a legal system to function requires a premise that can't itself be part of the legal system. And that premise is you have a moral obligation to obey the law. You can't pass a law saying you have an obligation to obey the law for obvious question-begging reasons. So there's got to be a kind of prior premise that you have a moral obligation to obey the law. To some extent, we get that from the Ten Commandments, but they become politicized over the course of years in ways you'll probably want to discuss.
Absolutely. And perhaps it's just my perception, and we need to take a break here in a moment, but are we hearing the Ten Commandments referred to more often in politics recently, do you feel?
Well, I don't have a content analysis, but I think it all goes back to the school prayer decisions, I think, of the early 1960s, when the Supreme Court said that it was not constitutionally consistent with the First Amendment to, for government officials to compose prayers. That was the Engle versus Vitale case, or to require Bible reading in class. Now, that's different from Bible study. The court has always said that you are certainly entitled to and indeed encouraged to learn about the Bible, whichever Bible you're talking about, because there are multiple Bibles. But with the decline of school prayer, organized Bible readings in the schools, I think the Ten Commandments have taken on a symbolic importance. Okay. We can talk about more in a moment.
And we will in just a moment. Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University, is here. Bob Cargill, assistant professor of classics and religious studies at the University of Iowa, and Diana Cates, departmental chair and professor of religious ethics in the religious studies department of the University of Iowa. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Ten Commandments, their role in our culture, their role in politics, of course, their role in religion as well. We'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to focus now on the Ten Commandments as a symbol in our culture. There is a very recent example of this symbol. A new Ten Commandments monument was installed on the Oklahoma State Capitol grounds just a couple of weeks ago to replace a previous one that was destroyed when a man drove his car into it. That's a whole another story. But this is a monument that has certainly been in the news a lot. There have been other monuments around the country that have sparked controversy, courthouses. This is a list that a lot of people want to be visible. And as we talk about this as a symbol with me, Dennis Goldford, he's professor of political science at Drake University, Flansburg Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, Diana Cates, departmental chair and professor of religious ethics in the Religious Studies Department at the University of Iowa, and Bob Cargill, assistant professor of classics and religious studies, also at the University of Iowa. Dennis, when we see the controversy over a large monument of the Ten Commandments on the lawn of a state capitol and, you know, displayed in other places, why is this symbol so important to some people to fight to have it erected on the lawn of the state house?
Well, I think what's basically at stake, and it's something I tried to argue in that book I published, is that is being an American, is the meaning of being an American to be a member not just of a civic community as Americans, but does it mean that we're members of a religious community as well? And typically that's considered Christian in some sense. So you will hear lots of more conservative candidates and politicians and others, pastors and others, talk about how we as a nation are responsible to God. And you can argue that we as individuals might be, depending upon our religious tradition, but that the nation itself is not a religious community. But with the prohibition on organized school prayer and Bible reading in some religious sense, as I said, I think the Ten Commandments have been introduced as a way to hold on to that notion, which itself was Protestant Christian, that America is in some sense a religious community with religious obligations to God. And we've been through this issue of Ten Commandments monuments before. Of course, the Supreme Court had two cases decided in 2005, the McCreary case in Kentucky, where they struck down posting the Ten Commandments in a particular display that was ostensibly about the sources of American law. But they upheld a monument, I think it was from the Fraternal Order of Eagles, that stood on the State House grounds in Texas, the Van Orden case. But part of the constitutional argument was, and this reaches back to what Bob started talking very ably about at the start of the hour, that from a constitutional sense, there is no non-sectarian version of the Ten Commandments. Different versions of the Ten Commandments differ in terms of number, ordering, translations that are grounded in theological differences. And for government in some sense to post a version of the Ten Commandments, so the argument has gone, is to endorse that particular religious tradition. And so that's why that became controversial. We'll see if this new Oklahoma issue gets litigated, if it is, whether it will come in under the McCreary non-constitutional or unconstitutional argument or the Van Orden constitutional argument.
And Bob, I know you have some thoughts on this as well.
Well, the question is often asked, excuse me, why the Ten Commandments? If we are as Dennis said, you know, a by and large a Protestant Christian nation, that was not necessarily the case at the founding, but we certainly that they rose to power. If that's the case, why not a cross? I mean, we also see crosses being planted in public places, government-owned places being litigated as well. Why
there,
the
there is that interrupt a Christian flag of America. Which you may have seen, a white flag with a blue square and a red cross inside of it. So, Bob, there is a Christian flag
right.
of America,
and I've seen these at Christian concerts. They trot this out, keeping in mind that a lot of the European nations have crosses throughout. You know, to symbolize they were founded as Christian nations. I think it's interesting that we were not. We may have been founded by many Christians, but we weren't founded as an overtly Christian nation. We were.
I think some people would argue with you.
I would welcome that debate. But I think it's the Ten Commandments for this reason. One, it's a law code. So it's not like a cross. It's a law code. And that symbol fits legislature, you know, legislating, you know, America's legal system. So it's a law code. Two is you maintain Jewish buy-in. If you plant a cross, you lose basically the endorsement, or at least the perceived endorsement, of many Jews that live in this country. Whereas if you go with the Ten Commandments, you've preserved this Judeo-Christian buy-in, keeping in mind that six of the Supreme Court justices are Catholic and three are Jewish. So if the Ten Commandments, I think, works as a law code, as a symbol, but also because it preserves the Judaism part of Judeo-Christian.
Helena is on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Helena.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
A point of history. When I moved to Iowa City some 20-plus years ago, there was a placard leading up to the Johnson County Courthouse with the Ten Commandments on it. I found that outrageous, and I launched a campaign speaking out about it, writing letters to the editor, et cetera, suggesting either that it be removed promptly or that they add placards from all of the other words of wisdom from all of the other cultures. Eventually, that was removed. I don't know whether my efforts achieved that or whether, you know, it just happened. But Iowa has something to look back on.
Well, Helena, can I ask you, why was that so offensive to you?
I am an atheist, and I have been subjected to Christian domination all of my growing up here. So that was why I found it offensive, particularly when Johnson County Courthouse did for the rule of law, which I understood not to be necessarily what Christians thought of as the rule of law.
Helena, thank you so much for sharing that experience with us. And Diana, I want to ask you, we've heard from both Dennis and Bob on why the Ten Commandments, why this symbol. You were talking about how these other more amorphous moral codes seem to be something that has made it into our minds and the way we act in culture. Why don't we see the golden rule up in front of courthouses and state houses?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I think the Ten Commandments are an important symbol. And to me, because we always think of the Ten Commandments in terms of the story, and we think of the story as one where God actually reveals God's will to Moses on Mount Sinai, and then Moses communicates this will to the rest of the people, that what we really have here is a symbol of a moral code that has its basis in eternal law, unchanging eternal law. And means that it's universal for all time, universal for all people, and will never change, and nobody is ever fully, you know, permitted or tolerated to disobey it. And what's interesting to me about that is that if the idea is, if it's an eternal law, it's not simply God's will. It's actually part of the way that the world was created, the way that the universe is ordered. So the idea is that if you don't follow these laws, creation itself will start to unravel, and we'll all be the worse off for that. We'll be, you know, lucky if we survive at all. So I think that kind of weight is attached to the Ten Commandments because they seem to have come from God, which is the principle of order in the universe, and the law of God is eternal.
Now, obviously, for a culture to survive, we need to have some sort of agreement on a moral code, as an understanding of what being a decent citizen is, but we have laws for that. I mean, Dennis, when we hear politicians hearkening back to the Ten Commandments, I mean, we heard most recently Michelle Bachmann in her farewell speech. She said the U.S. law is based upon the Ten Commandments. This is something that we hear a lot of rhetoric about. But we have a rule of law in this nation. It goes back a very long time. Why do we hearken to the Ten Commandments instead of this is the law of the land?
Well, first of all, that claim is made quite often, but there, at least in the popular discourse, there's never any real work done on showing exactly particular connections. As I suggested earlier, many of these things aren't part of the standard civil or criminal law in the United States. But I think, picking up on what Diana said, I think there's this fear that things decided by human beings alone can be violated or ignored by human beings. That if the law is simply a matter of what we decide, and there's one school of thought that says that even what we take to be eternal law is subject to our decision as to what eternal law is. But nevertheless, the view is that if we decide what our ultimate standards are, we can change those, and therefore they're not really ultimate standards. So there's this fear of being disconnected from any certainty, absolute certainty. And there's a certain element of human nature, greater in some people, less in others, I think, that crave certainty, if not absolute certainty. And the Ten Commandments, if not the overtly Christian version of religion, as Bob mentioned, the commandments as opposed to the cross, provide for some people at least some anchor for some notion of a moral code, which itself is the anchor to a successful legal system.
Bob?
I like to point out that, again, I think Dennis is right on the money. It's the argument that if you don't have an objective moral code, which is also based on God, and it's always God. It's never Jesus. It's always God. Again, to preserve this Judeo-Christian tradition is reflective of the founding of this nation. You know, I always, when people say we're founded as a Christian nation, I object and say we were founded by many Christians, but also by many deists. And I think the common ground, kind of the compromise, was deism, a reference to, in general, to a creator. You know, go look for the name of Jesus or the a mention of Christianity in the Declaration of Independence, in the Constitution. They're not there. But you do have these references to a creator. This is why so many scholars talk about the deistic principles. That is, the affirmation that there is a God and that he is watching out for us, specifically for our nation. And I think this is why you have the bias, as Helena mentioned in her call, against anti-theists or atheists or agnostics. That is, people object more to atheists trying to impose what they believe to be non-theistic laws than they do to Jews who may adamantly disagree. I mean, the Jewish-Christian arguments throughout history are quite famous and not pretty. But for some reason, that at least that acknowledgement of a deity as one who formed the world and our nation is a little more comforting than the idea that we get to actually decide for ourselves as we decide how we ought to treat one another.
Let me note quickly that John Locke, in his letter on toleration, called for toleration of various religious groups, saying, what does it matter to me if somebody believes something else? But the one group he didn't allow toleration for was atheists. But it wasn't for theological reasons. It was the fear that atheists would have no sanction or penalty if they didn't keep their word or keep their promises. So Locke was concerned about there being an ultimate sanction. And that's why, as you read the list of the Atheist Ten Commandments, they sounded sounded a lot milder and gentle than the sterner sounding regular Ten Commandments, so to speak.
Diana, what is the difference between a moral code like the Ten Commandments and the code of law?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, I think the traditionally, religions have regarded a moral code as one that not only limits people's behaviors, but one that tries to change their attitudes about what's important in life. It tries to set their values in a particular direction. It tries to, you know, bring up new generations to share those values. And so in many ways, it can be much more aspirational than law. That's one thing I noticed about the relationship between these two commandments or non-commandments is that the usual way the Ten Commandments are framed are almost all negative laws. You shall not do this, you shall not do that. And they are mostly focused on behavior, even though we have that coveting command. Whereas these new laws are much more aspirational. I mean, some of these are actually more like aphorisms than they are like commandments.
You can imagine it on a poster with a mountain behind it, right?
Correct.
Yeah. But it's more, you know, it's more about aspiring to be a, you know, I think in their view, a grown up who, doesn't need to believe in God anymore in order to think
make responsible decisions.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
This
yeah.
is an interesting email from Ben in Des Moines. A lot of people talk about separation of church and state to protect government. He says, "I suspect what many religiously oriented people forget is that if they succeed in integrating their religion into politics, then what they will get is politics only. Politics corrupts everything, even religion. They will have effectively ceded their religious belief to a system that will eventually have a different religion than their own in charge, and they will have established the precedence of a religion being able to tell them what to do by law. This is why, if you're a religious believer or not, it's important to keep religion and government separate," which is a thought-provoking argument. But Dennis, I mean, is there something to that? Is there something we need to guard against?
Well, I hate neologisms, but I have to say, if you religify politics, you politicize religion. Mm. And my argument has been that the Constitution does not protect religion. That may sound astounding, but it protects religious freedom. Mm-hmm. That's very different. If you say the Constitution protects religious freedom, you're on your way down the road to blasphemy laws and other such things. But our focus, the only way to make sense out of the existence of the First Amendment religion clauses and the prohibition on a religious test for office, is to understand the importance in our system, at least, of religious freedom. And in fact, a number of ministers during the time of the ratification of the Constitution opposed ratification because it said nothing about God, Christianity, or anything like that.
Dennis, thank you so much.
Sure, my pleasure.
Dennis Goldberg, professor of political science at Drake University, Flansburgh fellow at Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, also author of The Constitution of Religious Freedom, God, Politics, and the First Amendment. Diana Cates, thank you so much. Diana Cates, departmental chair and professor of religious ethics in the Religious Studies Department of the University of Iowa. And Bob Cargill, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Charity.
Assistant professor of classics and religious studies at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. The show is produced by Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow is Horticulture Day. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.